This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Deacon King Kong by James McBride. Read for you by Dominic Hoffman. Chapter 1. Jesus's Cheese. Deacon Cuffy Lamkin of Five Ends Baptist Church became a walking dead man on a cloudy September afternoon in 1969. That's the day the old deacon, known as Sportcoat to his friends, marched out to the plaza of the Causeway Housing Projects in South Brooklyn, stuck an ancient .45 caliber Luger in the face of a 19-year-old drug dealer named Deems Clemens, and pulled the trigger. There were a lot of theories floating around the projects as to why old Sportcoat, a wiry, laughing, brown-skinned man who had coughed, wheezed, hacked, guffawed, and drank his way through the cause houses for a good part of his 71 years, shot the most ruthless drug dealer the projects had ever seen. He had no enemies. He had coached the projects' baseball team for 14 years. His late wife, Hetty, had been the Christmas club treasurer of his church. He was a peaceful man, beloved by all. So, what happened? The morning after the shooting, the daily gathering of retired city workers, flophouse bums, bored housewives, and ex-convicts who congregated in the middle of the projects at the park bench near the flagpole to sip free coffee and salute Old Glory as it was raised to the sky, had all kinds of theories about why Old Sportcoat did it.
Sportcoat had rheumatic fever, declared Sister Veronica G., the president of the Cause Houses Tenant Association and wife of the minister at Five Ends Baptist Church, where Sportcoat had served for 15 years. She told the gathering that Sportcoat was planning to preach his first-ever sermon that upcoming Friends and Family Day at Five Ends Baptist, titled, "Don't Eat the Dressing Without Confessing." She also threw in that the church's Christmas club money was missing. But if Sportcoat took it, it was on account of that fever, she noted. Sister T.J. Billings, known affectionately as Bum Bum, head usher at Five Ends, whose ex-husband was the only soul in that church's storied history to leave his wife for a man and live to tell about it, he moved to Alaska, had her own theory. She said Sportcoat shot Deems because the mysterious ants had returned to Building 9. Sportcoat, she said grimly, is under an evil spell. There's a mojo about. Miss Izzy Cordero, vice president of the Puerto Rican Statehood Society of the Cause Houses, who had actually been standing just 30 feet away when Sportcoat pointed his ancient pea shooter at Deem's skull and cut loose, said the whole ruckus started because Sportcoat was blackmailed by a certain evil Spanish gangster, and she knew exactly who that gangster was and planned to tell the cops all about him. Of course, everybody knew she was talking about her Dominican ex-husband, Joaquin, who was the only honest numbers runner in the projects, and that she and her Joaquin hated each other's guts and each had worked to get the other arrested for the last 20 years. So, there was that. Hot Sausage, the Cause House's janitor and Sportcoat's best friend, who raised the flag each morning and doled out free coffee care of the Cause Houses Senior Center, told the gathering that Sportcoat shot Deems on account of the annual baseball game between the Cause Houses and their rival, the Watch Houses, being canceled 2 years before.
Sportcoat, he said proudly, is the only umpire both teams allowed.
But it was Dominic Lafleur, the Haitian cooking sensation, who lived in Sportcoat's building, who best summed up everybody's feelings. Dominic had just returned from a 9-day visit to see his mother in Port-au-Prince, where he contracted and then passed around the usual strange third-world virus that floored half his building, sending residents crapping and puking
and avoiding him for days, though the virus never seemed to affect him. Dominic saw the whole stupid travesty through his bathroom window as he was shaving. He walked into his kitchen, sat down to eat lunch with his teenage daughter, who was quaking with a temperature of 103, and said, "I always knew old Sportcoat would do one great thing in life." The fact is, no one in the projects really knew why Sportcoat shot Deems. Not even Sportcoat himself. The old deacon could no more explain why he shot Deems than he could explain why the moon looked like it was made of cheese, or why fruit flies come and go, or how the city dyed the waters of the nearby Causeway Harbor green every St. Paddy's Day. The night before, he dreamed of his wife, Hetty, who had vanished during the great snowstorm of 1967. Sportcoat loved to tell that story to his friends.
"It was a beautiful day," he said. "The snow came down like ashes from the sky. It was just a big white blanket. The projects were so peaceful and clean. Me and Hetty ate some crabs that night, then stood by the window and watched the Statue of Liberty in the harbor. Then we went to sleep. In the middle of the night, she shook me woke. I opened my eyes and seen a light floating round the room. It was like a little candlelight. Round and round it went, then out the door. Hetty said, 'That's God's light.' I got to fetch some moonflowers out the harbor. She put on a coat and followed it outside." When asked why he didn't go to the nearby Causeway Harbor after her, Sportcoat was incredulous. "She was following God's light," he said. "Plus, the elephant was out there." He had a point. Tommy Elefanti, the elephant, was a heavyset, brooding Italian who favored ill-fitting suits and ran his construction and trucking businesses out of an old railroad boxcar at the harbor pier, two blocks from the Cause houses, and just a block from Sportcoat's church. The elephant and his silent, grim Italians, who worked in the dead of night hauling God knows what in and out of that boxcar, were a mystery. They scared the shit out of everybody. Not even Deems, evil as he was, fooled with them. So Sportcoat waited till the next morning to look for Hetty. It was Sunday. He rose early. The project residents were still asleep, and the freshly fallen snow was largely untouched. He followed her tracks to the pier, where they ended at the water's edge. Sportcoat stared out over the water and saw a raven flying high overhead. "It was beautiful," he told his friends. "It circled a few times, then flew high up and was gone." He watched the bird till it was out of sight, then trudged back through the snow to the tiny cinder block structure that was Five Ends Baptist Church, whose small congregation was gathering for its 8 a.m. service. He walked in just as Reverend G, standing at his pulpit in front of the church's sole source of heat, an old wood stove, was reading off the sick and shut-in prayer list. Sportcoat took a seat in a pew amid a few sleepy worshipers, picked up a tiny one-sheet church program, and scrawled in a shaky hand, "Hetty," then handed it to the usher, Sister G, who was dressed in white. She walked it up to her husband and handed it to him just as Pastor G began reading the list out loud. The list was always long, and it usually bore the same names anyway. This one sick in Dallas, that one dying out in Queens someplace, and of course, Sister Paul, an original founder of Five Ends. She was 102 and had been living in an old folks' home way out in Bensonhurst so long that only two people in the congregation actually remembered her. In fact, there was some question as to whether Sister Paul was still alive, and there was some general noise in the congregation that maybe somebody, like the pastor, ought to ride out there and check.
I would go, Pastor G said, but I like my teeth. Everybody knew the white folks in Bensonhurst weren't fond of the Negro. Besides, the pastor noted cheerfully, Sister Paul's tithes of $4.13 came by mail faithfully every week, and that was a good sign. Standing at his pulpit, mumbling down the sick and shut-in prayer list, Pastor G received the paper bearing Hetty's name without a blink. When he read out her name, he smiled and quipped, "Get in your soul, brother. A working wife is good for life." It was a funny dig at Sportcoat, who hadn't held a steady job in years, while Hetty raised their only child and still worked a job. Reverend G was a handsome, good-natured man who liked to joke, though at the time he was fresh off scandal himself, having recently been spotted over at Silky's Bar on Van Marl Street, trying to convert a female subway conductor with boobs the size of Milwaukee. He was on thin ice with the congregation because of it. So when no one laughed, his face grew stern, and he read Hetty's name aloud, then sang, "Somebody's Calling My Name." The congregation joined in, and they all sang and prayed, and Sportcoat felt better. So did Reverend G. That night, Hetty still didn't come home. 2 days later, the Elephant's men discovered Hetty floating near the shore at the pier, her face gently draped with a scarf she'd worn around her neck when she left the apartment. They pulled her out of the bay, wrapped her in a wool blanket, laid her gently on a large tuft of clean white snow near the boxcar, then sent for Sportcoat. When he got there, they handed him a fifth of scotch without a word, called the cops, and then vanished. The Elephant wanted no confusion. Hetty was not one of his. Sportcoat understood. Hetty's funeral was the usual death extravaganza at Five Ends Baptist. Pastor G was an hour late to the service because gout had swollen his feet so badly he couldn't get his church shoes on. The funeral director, old white-haired Morris Hurley, whom everybody called Hurley Gurley behind his back because, well, everybody knew Morris was, well, he was cheap and talented and always 2 hours late with the body. But everybody knew Hetty would look like $1 million, which she did. The delay gave Pastor G a chance to preside over a hank between the ushers about the flower arrangements. No one knew where to put them. Hetty had been the one who always figured out where the flowers went, placing the geraniums in this corner, and the roses near this pew, and the azaleas by the stained glass window to comfort this or that family. But today, Hetty was the guest of honor, which meant the flowers were scattered helter-skelter, just where the delivery men dropped them. So it took Sister G stepping in as usual to figure that out. Meanwhile, Sister Bibb, the voluptuous church organist, who at 55 years old was thick-bodied, smooth, and brown as a chocolate candy bar, arrived in terrible shape. She was coming off her once-a-year sin jamboree, an all-night, two-fisted, booze-guzzling, swig-faced affair of delicious tongue-and-groove-licking and love-smacking with her sometimes boyfriend, Hot Sausage, until Sausage withdrew from the festivities for lack of endurance. "Sister Bibb," he once complained to Sportcoat, "is a grinder, and I don't mean organ." She arrived with a pounding headache and a sore shoulder from some kind of tugging from last night's howling bliss. She sat at her organ in a stupor, her head resting on the keys, as the congregation wandered in. After a few minutes, she left the sanctuary and headed for the basement ladies' room, hoping it was empty. But she stumbled down the stairs on the way and twisted her ankle badly. She suffered the injury without blasphemy or complaint, vomited last night's revelry into the toilet of the empty bathroom, refreshed her lipstick and checked her hair, then returned to the sanctuary, where she played the whole service with her ankle swollen to the size of a cantaloupe. She limped back to her apartment afterward, furious and repentant, spitting venom at Hot Sausage, who had gotten his breath back from the previous night's tumble, and now wanted more. He followed her home like a puppy, lingering half a block behind her, crouching behind the mulberry bushes that lined the project's walkways. Every time Sister Bibb looked over her shoulder and saw Hot Sausage's pork pie hat protruding over the bushes, she flew into a rage.
"Get gone, varmint," she snapped. "I'm done marrying with you."
Sportcoat, however, arrived at the church in great shape, having spent the previous night celebrating Hetty's life with his buddy Rufus Harley, who was from his hometown and was his second best friend in Brooklyn after Hot Sausage. Rufus was janitor at the nearby watch houses just a few blocks off, and while he and Hot Sausage didn't get along, Rufus was from South Carolina, while Sausage hailed from Alabama, Rufus made a special blend of white lightning known as King Kong that everyone, even Hot Sausage, enjoyed. Sportcoat didn't like the name of Rufus's specialty and over the years had proposed several names for it.
"You could sell this stuff like hoe cakes if it weren't named after a gorilla," he said once. "Why not call it Nelly's Nightcap or Gideon's Sauce?"
But Rufus always scoffed at the notions. "I used to call it Sonny Liston," he said, referring to the feared Negro heavyweight champ whose hammer-like fists knocked opponents out cold, "till Muhammad Ali came along." Sportcoat had to agree that by whatever name, Rufus's White Lightning was the best in Brooklyn. The night had been long and merry with talk of their hometown of Possum Point, and the next morning Sportcoat was in fine shape, seated in the first pew of Five Ends Baptist, smiling as the ladies in white fussed over him and the two best singers in the choir got into a fight over the church's sole microphone. Church fights are normally hushed, hissy affairs, full of quiet backstabbing, intrigue, and whispered gossip about bad rice and beans. But this spat was public, the best kind. The two choir members involved, Nanette and Sweetcorn, known as the Cousins, were both 33, beautiful, and wonderful singers. They had been raised as sisters, still lived together, and had recently had a terrible spat about a worthless young man from the projects named Pudding. The results were fantastic. The two took their rage at each other out on the music, each trying to outdo the other, hollering with glorious savagery about the coming redemption of our mighty King and Savior, Jesus, the Christ of Nazareth. Reverend G, inspired by the sight of the cousins' lovely breasts swelling beneath their robes as they roared, followed with a thunderous eulogy to make up for his joke about Hetty when she was already dead in the harbor, which made the whole thing the best home-going service Five Ends Baptist had seen in years. Sportcoat watched it all in awe, reveling in the spectacle with delight, marveling at the willing workers in their white dresses and fancy hats who scurried about and fussed over him and his son, Pudgy Fingers, who sat next to him. Pudgy Fingers, 26, blind, and said to be half a loaf short in his mind, had evolved from childhood fat to sweet slimness, his etched chocolate features hidden by expensive dark glasses donated by some long-forgotten social service agency worker. He ignored everything, as usual, though he didn't eat afterward at the church meal, which wasn't normal for Pudgy Fingers. But Sportcoat loved it.
"It was wonderful," he told his friends after the service. "Hetty would have loved it."
That night he dreamed of Hetty, and like he often did in the evenings when she was alive, he told her the titles of sermons he planned to preach one day, which usually amused her, since he always had the titles, but never the content.
"God Bless the Cow," and "I Thank Him for the Corn," and "Boo," said the chicken.
But that night she seemed irritated, sitting in a chair in a purple dress, her legs crossed, listening with a frown as he talked. So he brought her up to date on the cheery news of her funeral. He told her how beautiful her service was, the flowers, the food, the speeches, and the music, and how happy he was that she had received her wings and gone on to her reward, though she could have left him a little advice about how he could get hold of her Social Security. Didn't she know it was a pain to stand in line downtown at the Social Security office all day? And what about the Christmas Club money she collected, where the members of 5Ns put away money every week so they could buy Christmas gifts in December for their kids? Hetty was the treasurer, but she had never said where she hid the money. "Everybody asking about their Jack," he said. "You should have told where you hid it." Hetty ignored the question as she fluffed at a wrinkled spot in her bodice. "Stop talking to the child in me," she said. "You've been talking to the child in me 51 years.
"Where's the money?"
"Check your poop hole, you drinking dog.
We got some chips in there too, you know."
"We?" she smirked.
"You ain't throwed a dime in there in 20 years, you joy juice swilling, lazy, no good bum."
She stood up. And just like that, they were off, arguing like the old days, a catfight that developed into the usual roaring, fire-breathing, ass-out brawl that continued after he awoke, with her following him around as usual, with her hands on her hips, tossing zingers while he tried to walk away, snapping back responses over his shoulder. They argued that day, and the next, fussing right through breakfast, lunch, and into the next day. To an outsider, Sportcoat appeared to be talking to walls as he went about his usual duties, down into the project's boiler room for a quick snort with hot sausage, back up the stairs to apartment 4G, out again to take Pudgy Fingers to where the bus picked him up to take him to the Blind People's Social Center, then out to work his usual odd jobs, and then back home again. Wherever he went, the two of them fussed. Or at least, Sportcoat did. The neighbors could not see Hetty, of course. They just stared at him talking to someone nobody could see. Sportcoat paid them no mind when they stared. Fussing with Hetty was the most natural thing in the world to do. He'd done it for 40 years. He couldn't believe it. Gone was the tender, shy, sweet little thing that giggled back in Possum Point when they slipped into the high corn of her daddy's garden and he poured wine down her shirt and thumbed her boobs. Now she was all New York, insolent, mouthy, and fresh, appearing out of nowhere at the oddest times of the day. And each time, wearing a new damn wig on her head, which, he suspected, was something she'd received from the Lord as a gift for her life struggles. The morning he shot Deems, she'd appeared as a redhead, which startled him. And worse, she flew into a rage when he asked for the umpteenth time about the Christmas Club money. "Woman, where's them dollars? I got to come up with them people's chips."
"I ain't got to tell it."
"That's stealing."
"Look who's talking. The cheese thief."
That last crack stung him. For years, the New York City Housing Authority, a mega mass of bloated bureaucracy, a hotbed of grift, graft, games, payola bums, deadbeat dads, payoff racketeers, and old-time political appointees who lorded over the cause houses and every other one of New York's 45 housing projects with arrogant inefficiency, had inexplicably belched forth a phenomenal gem of a gift to the cause houses. Free cheese. Who pushed the button? Who filled out the paperwork? Who made the cheese magically appear? No one knew. Not even Bum Bum, who made it her cause d'etre for years to find out the origin of the cheese. The assumption was it came from housing, but nobody was stupid enough to awaken that beast by calling downtown to ask. Why bother? The cheese was free. It came like clockwork for years,
every first Saturday of the month, arriving like magic in the wee hours in Hot Sausage's boiler room in the basement of Building 17. 10 crates of it, freshly chilled in 5-pound hunks. This wasn't plain old housing project's cheese food, nor was it some smelly, curdled, reluctant Swiss cheese material snatched from a godforsaken bodega someplace, gathering mold in some dirty display case while mice gnawed at it nightly, to be sold to some sucker fresh from Santo Domingo. This was fresh, rich, heavenly, succulent, soft, creamy, kiss my ass, cows gotta die for this delightfully salty, moo ass, good old white folks cheese. Cheese to die for, cheese to make you happy. Cheese to beat the cheese boss, cheese for the big cheese, cheese to end the world, cheese so good it inspired a line every first Saturday of the month. Mothers, daughters, fathers, grandparents, disabled in wheelchairs, kids, relatives from out of town, white folks from nearby Brooklyn Heights, and even South American workers from the garbage processing plant on Concord Avenue, all patiently standing in a line that stretched from the interior of Hot Sausage's boiler room to Building 17's outer doorway, up the ramp to the sidewalk, curling around the side of the building and to the plaza near the flagpole. The unlucky ones at the end of the line were forced to constantly watch over their shoulders for the cops. Free or not, something this good had to have an angle. While the ones near the front of the line salivated and edged forward anxiously, hoping the supply would last, knowing that to get within sight of the cheese and then witness the supply run out was akin to experiencing sudden coitus interruptus. Naturally, Sportcoat's affinity with the very important distributor of that item, Hot Sausage, guaranteed him a hunk no matter what the demand, which was always good news for him and Hetty. Hetty especially loved that cheese, so her crack about it infuriated him.
"You ate that cheese, didn't you?" Sportcoat said. "You ate it like a butcher's dog every time, stolen or not. You liked it."
It was from Jesus. That drove him wild, and he harangued her till she disappeared. Their fights in the weeks previous to the shooting had become so heated, he had begun to rehearse his arguments to himself before she appeared, drinking booze in her absence to clarify his thoughts and wipe the cobwebs out of his mind so he could lay out his reasoning clearly and show her who was boss once she showed up, which made him seem even more bizarre to the residents of the cause houses, seeing Sportcoat in the hall, holding a bottle of Rufus's homemade King Kong in the air and saying to no one in particular, "Who's bringing the cheese, Jesus or me? If I'm the one standing in line for the cheese, and I'm the one fetching the cheese, and I'm the one hauling the cheese home in the rain and snow, who's bringing the cheese, Jesus or me?" His friends excused it. His neighbors ignored it. His church family at Five Ends shrugged. Big deal. So Sport was a little crazy. Everybody in the cause had a reason to be a little left-handed. Take Neva Ramos, the Dominican beauty in Building 5 who poured a glass of water on the head of any man stupid enough to stand beneath her window. Or Dub Washington from Building 7, who slept in an old factory at Vitale Pier and got busted every winter for shoplifting at the same Park Slope grocery store. Or Bum Bum, who stopped in front of the picture of the black Jesus painted on the wall of Five Ends each morning before work to pray aloud for the destruction of her ex-husband, that the Lord might set his balls on fire and they might sizzle on a frying pan like 2 tiny, flattened potato pancakes. It was all explainable. Neva got wronged on her job by her boss. Dub Washington wanted a warm jail. Sister Bum Bum's husband left her for a man. So what? Everyone had a reason to be crazy in the cause. There was mostly a good reason behind everything. Until Sportcoat shot Deems. That was different. Trying to find reason in that was like trying to explain how Deems went from being a cute pain in the ass and the best baseball player the projects had ever seen to a dreadful, poison-selling, murderous meathead with all the appeal of a cyclops. It was impossible. If there's no time limit on fortune cookie predictions, Sportcoat might make it, Bum Bum said. But outside of that, I reckon he's on the short list. She was right. Everyone agreed. Sportcoat was a dead man. Chapter 2. A Dead Man. Of course the folks in the cause houses had predicted Sportcoat's death for years. Every year in the spring, when the project residents would emerge from their apartments like burrowed groundhogs to walk along the plaza and sample whatever good air was left in the causeway, much of it polluted from the nearby wastewater treatment plant, some resident would spy Sportcoat staggering through the plaza after a night of binging on King Kong Rotgut at Rufus's, or playing bidwhist at Silky's bar over on Van Marl Street and say, "He's done." When he caught the flu back in 58, which floored half of Building 9 and gave Deacon Erskine of Mighty Hand Gospel Tabernacle his final wings, Sister Bum Bum declared, "He's going up yonder." When the ambulance came to get him after his third stroke in 62, Ginny Rodriguez of Building 19 grumbled, "He's finished." That was the same year that Miss Izzy of the Puerto Rican Statehood Society won raffle tickets to see the New York Mets at the Polo Grounds. She predicted the Mets, who had lost 120 games that year, would win. And they did. Which encouraged her to announce Sportcoat's death 2 weeks later, explaining that Dominic Lafleur, the Haitian sensation, had just arrived back from Port-au-Prince after visiting his mother, and she actually saw Sportcoat drop in his tracks right in front of his apartment on the fourth floor from the strange virus Dominic brought back that year. "He went fatty boom bang," she exclaimed. "Gone. Quit. Out of here." She even pointed to the black van from the city morgue that showed up that night and hauled out a body as proof, only to recant the whole bit the next morning when it turned out the body they'd claimed belonged to the Haitian sensation's brother, El Haji, who had converted to Islam and broken his mother's heart, then collapsed of a heart attack after his first day on the job driving a city bus, after trying to get on at transit for 3 years, too. Imagine that. Still, Sportcoat seemed earmarked for death. In fact, even the cheerful souls at Five Ends Baptist, where Sportcoat served as a deacon and president of the Five Ends chapter of the Grand Brotherhood of the Brooklyn Elks Lodge, number 47, which for the grand sum of $16.75, paid annually, money order only, please, had a standing guarantee from the head honchos at Five Ends Baptist to funeralize any and all Brooklyn Elks Lodge members who need final servicing at cost, of course. With Sportcoat serving as honorary pallbearer, had predicted his death. Sportcoat, Sister Veronica G. of Five Ends said soberly, is a sick man. She was right. At 71, Sportcoat had contracted almost every disease known to man. He had gout. He had the piles. He had rheumatoid arthritis, which crippled his back so bad he limped like a hunchback on overcast days. He had a cyst on his left arm the size of a lemon, and a hernia in his groin the size of an orange. When the hernia grew to the size of a grapefruit, doctors recommended surgery. Sportcoat ignored them, so a kind social worker at the local health clinic signed him up for every alternative therapy known to man. Acupuncture, magnet therapy, herbal remedies, holistic healing, applying leeches, gait analysis, and plant remedies with genetic variations. None of them worked. With each failure, his health declined further, and the death predictions grew more frequent and ominous. But not one of them came true. The fact is, unbeknownst to the residents of the cause, the death of Cuffy Jasper Lamkin, which was Sportcoat's real name, had been predicted long before he arrived at the cause houses. When he was slapped to life back in Possum Point, South Carolina, 71 years before, the midwife who delivered him watched in horror as a bird flew through an open window and fluttered over the baby's head, then flew out again. A bad sign. She announced, "He's gonna be an idiot," handed him to his mother, and vanished, moving to Washington, D.C., where she married a plumber and never delivered another baby again. Bad luck seemed to follow the baby wherever he went. Baby Cuffy got colic, typhoid fever, the measles, the mumps, and scarlet fever. At age 2, he swallowed everything. Marbles, rocks, dirt, spoons, and once got a kitchen ladle caught in his ear, which had to be extracted by a doctor over at the University Hospital in Columbia. At age 3, when a young local pastor came by to bless the baby, the child barfed green matter all over the pastor's clean white shirt. The pastor announced, "He's got the devil's understanding," and departed for Chicago, where he quit the gospel and became a blues singer named Tampa Red and recorded the monster hit song Devil's Understanding before dying in anonymity, flat broke, and crawling into history, immortalized in music studies and rock and roll college courses the world over, idolized by white writers and music intellectuals for his classic blues hit that was the bedrock of the $40 million gospel stamp music publishing empire, from which neither he nor Sportcoat ever received a dime. At age 5, baby Sportcoat crawled to a mirror and spit at his reflection, a call sign to the devil, and as a result didn't grow back teeth until he was 9. His mother tried everything to make his back teeth grow. She dug up a mole, cut off its feet, and hung the feet on a necklace around the baby's neck. She rubbed fresh rabbit brains on his gums. She stuffed snake rattles, hog tails, and finally alligator teeth in his pockets to no avail. She let a dog tread on him, a sure remedy. But the dog bit him and ran off. Finally, she called an old medicine woman from the Sea Islands who cut a sprig of green bush, talked Cuffy's real name to it, and hung the bag upside down in the corner of the room. When she departed, she said, "Don't say his true name again for 8 months." The mother complied, calling him Sportcoat, a term she'd overheard while pulling cotton at the farm of J.C. Yancey of Barnwell County, where she worked shares, one of her white bosses uttering it to refer to his shiny new green and white plaid Sportcoat, which he proudly wore the very afternoon he bought it, cutting a dazzling figure upon his horse in the harsh southern sun, his shotgun across his lap, dozing atop his mount at the end of the cotton row, while the colored workers laughed up their sleeves and the other overseers snickered. 8 months later, she woke up and found the mouth of 10-year-old Sportcoat full of back teeth. She sought out the medicine woman excitedly, who came over, examined Cuffy's mouth, and said, "He's gonna have more teeth than an alligator." Whereupon the mother happily patted the boy on the head, lay down for a nap, and expired. The boy never recovered from his mother's death. The ache in his heart grew to the size of a watermelon. But the medicine woman was right. He grew enough teeth for 2 people. They sprouted like wildflowers. Bicuspids, molars, liners, fat, long, double chompers, wide teeth in the front, narrow teeth in the back. But there were too many of them, and they crowded his gums and had to be pulled out, the extractions dutifully done by delighted white dental students at the University of South Carolina, who desperately needed patients to work on to obtain their degrees,
and thus held Sportcoat dear, extracting his teeth and giving him sweet muffins and little bottles of whiskey as payment, for he'd discovered the magic of alcohol by then, in part to celebrate his father's marriage to his stepmother, who often recommended he go play at Sassafras Mountain, 258 miles distant, and jump off the top naked. At age 14, he was a drunk and a dental student's dream. By age 15, the medical school had discovered him as the first of many ailments gathered forces to attack him. At 18, blood poisoning blew up his lymph nodes to the size of marbles. Measles reappeared, along with a number of other diseases, which smelled the red meat of a sucker marked for death and dropped by his body for a go-around. Scarlet fever, hematoid illness, acute viral infection, pulmonary embolism. At 20, lupus had a throw and quit. When he was 29, a mule kicked him and broke his right eye socket, which sent him stumbling around for months. At 31, a cross-cut saw cut his left thumb off. The delighted medical students at the university sewed it back on with 74 stitches, chipped in, and bought him a used chainsaw as a gift, which he used to cut off his right big toe. They reattached that with 37 stitches, and as a result, two of the students won major medical internships at hospitals in the Northeast, and they sent him enough money to buy a second mule and a hunting knife, which he used to slice into his aorta by accident while skinning a rabbit. He fell unconscious that time and nearly died, but he was rushed to the hospital, where he lay dead on the operating table for 3 minutes, but came back again after a surgeon intern stuck a probe in his big toe, which sent him sitting up, cursing and swearing. At 50, measles came back for one last fling and quit. And thereupon, Cuffy Jasper Lambkin, rechristened Sportcoat by his mother, and loved and admired by all whom he knew in Possum Point save the two people responsible for his well-being in the world, his stepmother and father, left the entreaties of the grateful medical students of the state of South Carolina and ventured to New York City to join his wife, Hetty Purvis, his childhood sweetheart who had moved there and set things up nicely for him, having gotten a job as a domestic for a good white family in Brooklyn. He arrived at the Cause houses in 1949 spitting blood, coughing gruesome black phlegm, and drinking homemade Everclear, later switching to Rufus's beloved King Kong, which preserved him nicely until his 60s, at which point the operations began. Doctors removed him piece by piece, first a lung, then a toe, then a second toe, followed by the usual tonsils, bladder, spleen, and two kidney operations. All the while he drank till his balls hurt and he worked like a slave, for Sportcoat was a handyman. He could fix anything that walked or moved or grew. There was not a furnace, a TV, a window, or a car that he could not fix. What's more, Sportcoat, a child of the country, had the greatest green thumb of anyone in the Cause houses. He was friends with anything that grew. Tomatoes, herbs, butter beans, dandelions, beggar's lice, wild spur, bracken, wild geranium. There was not a plant that he could not coax out of its hiding place, nor a seed he could not force to the sun, nor an animal he could not summon or sick into action with an easy smile and affable strong hands. Sportcoat was a walking genius, a human disaster, a sod, a medical miracle, and the greatest baseball umpire that the Cause houses had ever seen, in addition to serving as coach and founder of the All-Cause Boys baseball team. He was a wondrous handyman to the residents of the Cause houses, the guy you called when your cat took a dump and left a little piece of poop hooked in his duff. Because Sportcoat was an old countryman, and nothing would turn him away from God's good purpose. Similarly, If your visiting preacher had diabetes and weighed 450 pounds and gorged himself with too much fatback and chicken thighs at the church repast, and your congregation needed a man strong enough to help that tractor-trailer-sized wide body off the toilet seat and out onto the bus back to the Bronx so somebody could lock up the dang church and go home, why, Sportcoat was your man. There was no job too small, no miracle too wondrous, no smell too noxious. Thus the sight of him staggering through the plaza each afternoon drunk, headed to some odd job, caused the residents to murmur to one another, "That fool's a wonder," while secretly saying to themselves, "All's right in the world." But all that, everyone agreed, changed the day he shot Deems Clemens. Clemens was the new breed of colored in the cause. Deems wasn't some poor colored boy from down south or Puerto Rico or Barbados who arrived in New York with empty pockets and a Bible and a dream. He wasn't humbled by a life of slinging cotton in North Carolina or hauling sugarcane in San Juan. He didn't arrive in New York City from some poor place where kids ran around with no shoes and ate chicken bones and turtle soup, limping to New York with a dime in their pockets, overjoyed at the prospect of coming to New York to clean houses and empty toilets and dump garbage, hoping for a warm city job or maybe even an education care of good white people. Deems didn't give a shit about white people, or education, or sugarcane, or cotton, or even baseball, which he had once been a whiz at. None of the old ways meant a penny to him. He was a child of cause, young, smart, and making money hand over fist slinging dope at a level never before seen in the cause houses. He had high friends and high connections from East New York all the way to Far Rockaway, Queens. And any fool in the cause stupid enough to open their mouth in his direction ended up hurt bad or buried in an urn in an alley someplace. Sportcoat, all agreed, had finally run out of luck. He was, truly, a dead man. Chapter 3. Jet. There were 16 witnesses at the Cause House's plaza when Sportcoat signed his death warrant. One of them was a Jehovah's Witness stopping passersby. Three were mothers with babies in carriages. One was Miss Izzy of the Puerto Rican Statehood Society. One was an undercover cop. Seven were dope customers, and three were Five Ends congregation members who were passing out flyers announcing the church's upcoming annual Friends and Family Day service, which would feature Deacon Sportcoat himself preaching his first ever sermon. Not one of them breathed a word to the cops about the shooting. Not even the undercover cop, a 22-year-old detective from the 76th Precinct named Jethro Jet Hardman, the first ever black detective in the cause houses. Jet had been working on Deems Clemens for 7 months. It was his first undercover assignment, and what he found made him nervous. Clemens, he'd learned, was the low-hanging fruit on a drug network that led up the food chain to Joe Peck, a major Italian crime figure in Brooklyn whose violent syndicate gave every patrolman in Jet's 76th precinct who valued his life the straight-out jitters. Peck had connections. Inside the precinct, down at Brooklyn City Hall, and with the Gorvino crime family. Guys who would stake out a claim on a cop's guts for a quarter and get away with it. Jet had been warned about Peck from his old partner, an elderly Irish sergeant named Kevin Potts Mullen, an honest cop recently returned to the precinct after being banished to Queens for the dreadful habit of actually wanting to lock up bad guys. A former detective busted back to swing sergeant. Potts had dropped by the precinct one afternoon to check on his former charge after discovering Jet had volunteered to work undercover in the cause houses.
Why risk your skin?
Potts asked him.
I'm kicking doors down, Potts, Jet said proudly. I like being first. I was the first Negro to play trombone in my elementary school, PS-29. Then first Negro in junior high school, 219, to join the math club. Now I'm the first black detective in the cause. It's a new world, Potts. I'm a groundbreaker.
You're an idiot, Potts said. They were standing outside the 7-6 as they talked. Potts, clad in his sergeant's uniform, leaned on the bumper of his squad car and shook his head.
Get out, he said. You're out of your league. I just got in, Potts. I'm cool.
You're in over your head.
It's just small-time stuff, Potts. Grift, jewelry, burglary, a little narcotics.
A little. What's your cover?
I'll be a janitor, with a drug habit. First black janitor in the projects, under the age of 23.
Potts shook his head.
This is drugs, he said.
So what?
Think of a horse, Potts said. Now, think of a fly on a horse's back. That's you. It's an opportunity, Potts. The force needs Negro undercovers.
Is that how the lieutenant sold it to you?
His exact words.
Why you dogging me, man? You worked undercover yourself.
That was 20 years ago.
Potts sighed, feeling hungry. It was nearly lunchtime, and he was thinking of mutton stew and bacon stew with potatoes, the latter of which he loved. That's how he got his nickname, Potts, from his grandmother. Because as a toddler, he couldn't say potato.
Undercover work was mostly memos back then, he said. Horse racing, burglaries, now it's heroin, cocaine. There's a load of money in it. Thank God the Italians around here in my day didn't like drugs.
You mean like Joe Peck or the elephant? Jet tried to keep the excitement out of his voice.
Potts frowned, then glanced over his shoulder at the precinct building to make sure nobody he knew was within earshot.
Those two got ears in this precinct. Leave him alone. Peck's crazy. He's probably going to get burnt by his own people.
The elephant? He shrugged.
He's old-fashioned. Trucking, construction, storage. He's a smuggler. He moves stuff out of the harbor. Cigarettes, tires, that kind of stuff. He doesn't work in drugs. He's a hell of a gardener.
Jet squinted at Potts, who seemed distracted.
He's a weird bird, the elephant. You'd think he'd favor Lionel trains or toy boats or something. His yard looks like a flower show.
Maybe he's growing flowers to hide marijuana plants, Jet said. That's illegal, by the way.
Potts sucked his teeth and shot an irritated glance at him.
I thought you liked to draw comic books.
I do, man. I draw them all the time.
Then get back in the blues and draw your comics at night.
You want to be the first at something? Be the first Negro cop smart enough to forget the Dick Tracy crap and retire with your head in one piece.
Who's Dick Tracy? Jet asked.
Don't you read the funny papers?
Jet shrugged.
Potts snickered.
Get out. Don't be an idiot.
Jet tried to get out. He actually broached the subject with his lieutenant, who ignored him. The 76th Precinct, which Jet had only recently joined as a detective, was a demoralized mess. The captain spent most of his time at meetings in Manhattan. The white cops didn't trust him. The few black cops, smelling his ambition and terrified about being transferred to East New York, considered hell on earth, avoided him. Most wanted to talk about nothing more than fishing upstate on weekends. The paperwork was overwhelming. 12 copies for a shoplifting arrest. The bomb squad sat around and played cards all day. Potts was the only one Jet trusted. And Potts, at 59, was biding his time to retirement with 1 foot out the door, having been demoted to sergeant for reasons he never discussed. Potts planned to retire in less than a year.
I'll get out, Jet said. After I've done it a year, then I can say I'm a pioneer.
All right, Custer. If it goes bad, I'll call your mom.
Come on, Potts. I'm a man. So was Custer.
The day of the shooting, Jet, clad in the blue Housing Authority janitor's uniform and leaning on his broom, was standing in the plaza daydreaming about taking a job in his cousin's cleaners and being the first Negro to invent a new shirt steamer, when he saw Sportcoat in his ragged sports jacket and beaten slacks teetering out of the dim hallway of Building 9 and drifting toward the crowd of boys around Clemens, who sat at the plaza flagpole surrounded by his crew and customers, not 10 feet from where Jet was standing. Jet noticed Sportcoat smiling, which was not unusual. He'd seen the ancient coot around, grinning and talking to himself. He watched as Sportcoat stopped for a moment in the crowded plaza, did a batter's pose, swung at an imaginary pitch, then straightened, stretched, and teetered forward. He chuckled and was about to turn away when he saw, or thought he saw, the old man pull out a large rusted pistol from his left jacket pocket and place it in his right-hand pocket. Jet looked around helplessly. This was what Potts called a situation. Most of his work up until this point had been smooth. Make a few buys. Take mental notes. ID this one, figure out that one. Get the lay of the land. Figure out where the spiderweb goes, which was to a supplier in Bed-Stuy called Bunch, and through a dreaded enforcer on Bunch's crew named Earl, who came around to distribute and collect. That was as far as Jet had gotten. There was a killer, he heard. A hitman named Harold, who was apparently so horrible that everyone seemed afraid to mention his name, including Deems himself. Jet hoped not to meet him. As it was, he wasn't feeling skippy about matters. Every time he briefed his lieutenant on his progress, the man seemed nonchalant. "Doing good. Doing good," was all he said. The lieutenant, Jet knew, was angling for a promotion and had one foot out the door, too, like most of the commanders at the 7-6. With the exception of Potts and a couple of kind older detectives, Jet was on his own, with no guidance and no direction, so he cooled it and did the job easy as Potts had instructed. No busts, no collars, no comments, do nothing, just watch. That's what Potts said. But this was something different. The old man was approaching with a gun. If Potts were in his shoes, what would he do? Jet glanced around. There were people everywhere. It was nearly noon, and the assortment of neighborhood gossips who met at the flagpole bench every morning to sip coffee and salute the flag had not quite departed. An odd truce had developed, Jet noticed, between Deems and his drug-slinging crew and the old-timers who came here every morning to gossip and insult one another with jokes. For a short period, between 11:30 and noon, the two groups actually shared the flagpole space. Deems worked a bench on one side of the flagpole, and the morning residents gathered on the other, mumbling about the declining state of the world, which included, Jet noticed, Deems himself. "I'd put a baseball bat to that little worm head if he was my son," Jet had heard Sister Veronica G. grumble once. Added Bum Bum, "I'd send him hobbling, but why interrupt my prayers?" Threw in Hot Sausage, "I'm going to warm his two little toasters one of these days, when I'm not under the influence." Deems, Jet noticed, ignored them, always keeping his foot traffic to a minimum until the old-timers departed, leaving the squabblings, the posturing, the cursing, the harsh arguments, even the fights, for later. Before noon, the plaza was safe. Until now, Jet thought. Jet checked his watch. It was 11:55. Some of the old-timers were starting to rise up from the bench, with the old man and his gun still coming, now 50 feet away, his hand thrust into his gun pocket. Jet felt his mouth go dry, watching the old drunk teeter forward 5 feet at a time,
stopping to swing an imaginary baseball bat, then swaying forward once more, taking his time, talking, apparently having a two-way conversation with himself.
"Ain't got time for you, woman. Not today, I don't. You're not yourself today anyway, and that's an improvement."
Jet watched, unbelieving, as Sportcoat closed to 40 feet, then 30, then 25, still talking to himself as he moved toward Deems. At 20 feet, the old man stopped muttering, but still he came on. Jet couldn't help himself, his training kicked in. He dropped to a crouch to grab the snub-nosed 38 strapped to his ankle, then stopped himself. A gun strapped to the ankle was a dead giveaway. It screamed cop. Instead, he stood up and drifted away as the old man circled the crowd surrounding Deems. As casually as he could, Jet walked to the wide circular concrete flag base, placing his broom against the base, stretched his arms, and feigned a tired yawn. He glanced at the bench where the old-timers sat, and he saw with alarm that a few of them were still there. They were laughing, saying a last word as they stood up, joking, taking their time. A couple of them glanced at Deems and his crew, who were gathering, happily ignoring the old folks on the opposite bench, the young troops surrounding their king. One of the boys handed his leader Deems a paper bag. Deems opened it and removed a large hero sandwich, unwrapping it. From where he was standing, Jet could smell it was tuna. He glanced at the old-timers.
"Hurry up."
Finally, the last of them stood up. He watched with relief as Hot Sausage grabbed the giant coffee thermos, and Bum Bum picked up the cardboard cups, and they were off, leaving only two, Miss Izzy and Sister G. Sister G got up first, her arms full of flyers, and wandered off. That left only Miss Izzy, a heavy-set, light-skinned Puerto Rican with shiny black hair whose laughter followed Sister G, her cackles sounding like chalk screeching across a blackboard.
"Get gone," Jet thought. "Go, go."
The elderly Puerto Rican woman watched Sister G drift off, rubbed her nose, scratched her armpit, glared at the gathering of drug users now circling Deems, said something in Spanish toward Deems, which Jet guessed was an oath, and finally began to amble away. Still, the old man came on, 10 feet. He smiled at Jet as he slipped past, smelling strongly of booze, then eased into the circle of heroin heads surrounding Clemens, disappearing from Jet's view behind the shoulders of the anxious users clamoring for their first hit of the day. Jet's fear amped into panic. What the fuck was the old fool thinking? He was going to get blasted. He waited for the bang, terrified, his heart racing. Nothing. The circle didn't move. The boys stood around Deems, bustling as usual, ribbing one another and joking. Jet snatched his broom off the flagpole and, pushing it toward the circle of boys, tried to appear nonchalant, absent-mindedly sweeping, picking up pieces of trash as he went, knowing that the normally careful Deems wouldn't bother noticing him, since he too was a customer. As he swept close to the group, he paused to tie his shoe this time, placing his broom on the ground. From this vantage point, low to the ground and less than 10 feet away, he could see through the angle of bodies straight into the circle surrounding Deems and the old man. Deems was seated on the back arm of the bench working on his hoagie, talking to another boy, the two of them, laughing. Neither noticed Sportcoat standing over them.
"Deems!"
the old man spoke up. Clemens looked up. He seemed surprised to see the old drunk swaying before him.
"Sportcoat, my man."
He bit into his sandwich, the tuna hero dripping with mayonnaise and tomatoes. Sportcoat always made him a little uncomfortable. It wasn't the old man's drinking or his bravado or his stern lectures about drugs that bothered him. Rather, it was the memory, not long ago, of Sport Coat shagging fly balls with him at the baseball field on warm spring afternoons. It was Sport Coat who taught him how to pivot and zing a throw to home plate from 350 feet out. It was Sport Coat who taught him how to pitch, to throw his weight on his back foot when he wound up, to extend his arm as he powered the ball home, to grip the ball properly to throw a curveball, and follow through with his legs so all his weight and power was on the ball, not on his shoulder. Sport Coat made him a star in baseball. He was the envy of the white boys on the John Jay High School baseball team, who marveled at the college scouts who risked life and limb to venture to the funky, dirty Cause Houses baseball field to watch him pitch. But that was another time, when he was a boy and his grandpa was living. He was a man now, 19, a man who needed money, and Sport Coat was a pain in the ass. "How come you ain't playing ball no more, Deems?" Sport Coat asked.
"Ball?"
Deems said, chewing.
"That's right. Baseball," Sport Coat said, swaying.
"Got bigger ball to play, Sport Coat," Deems said, winking at his cohorts as he took a second big bite of his sandwich.
The boys laughed. Deems wolfed another bite, barely looking at Sport Coat, his attention focused on the dripping sandwich, while Sport Coat stared, blinking dully.
"Ain't nothing bigger than ball, Deems."
"I don't know.
I'm the big cheese when it comes to ball round this projects."
"You right, Sport Coat. You the man. Best umpire this projects ever had,"
Sport Coat said proudly as he swayed.
"I brings the cheese. Not Peter, not Paul, not Jesus, me. I brings the cheese, see? And I has not excused you, Deems Clemens, from playing ball, you understand? For that is what you do best. So, how come you is not playing ball?"
Clemens, his hands clasped around the giant sandwich, chuckled and said,
"Go on, Sport Coat. You ain't answered me. I trained you to God's way, son. I taught you Sunday school. I teached you the game."
Deems' smile disappeared. The warm glow in his brown eyes vanished. A dark, vacant look replaced it. He was not in a mood for the old man's bullshit. His long, dark fingers clasping the hero tightened down on it tensely, squeezing out the white mayonnaise and tomato juice, which ran into his hands.
"Get gone, Sport Coat," he said.
He licked his fingers, bit into the sandwich again, and whispered a joke to a boy seated on the bench next to him, which sent the two of them chortling. At that moment, Sport Coat stepped back and calmly reached into his pocket. Jet, four steps away, still crouched, his hands on his shoelaces, saw the move and uttered the words that would ultimately save Deems' life. He howled out,
"He's got a burner!"
Clemens, with a mouthful of tuna sandwich, instinctively turned his head in the direction of Jet's shout. At that moment, Sport Coat fired. The blast, aimed at Deems' forehead, missed, and the bullet struck his ear instead, severing it, the spent bullet clanging off the pavement behind him. But the force of the blast felt like it took Deems' head off. It tossed him backward over the bench and threw the bite of tuna sandwich against the back of his throat and down his windpipe, choking him. He landed on his back, on the concrete, coughed a few times, then rolled onto his stomach and began choking, desperately trying to rise to his hands and knees as the stunned boys around him scattered and the plaza collapsed into chaos. Flyers dropping to the ground, mothers pushing baby carriages at a sprint, a man in a wheelchair spinning past, people running with shopping carts and dropping their grocery bags in panic, a mob of pedestrians fleeing in terror through the fluttering flyers that seemed to be everywhere. Sportcoat squared his old pistol on Deems again, but when he saw Deems on his hands and knees choking, he had a change of heart. He was suddenly confused. He had dreamed of Hetty the night before, wearing her red wig, hollering at him about the cheese. And now, he was standing over Deems. The dang thing in his hand had fired somehow, and Deems was on the ground in front of him trying to breathe. Watching him, Sportcoat had an epiphany.
No man, Sportcoat.